This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Black smoke just began emerging from the chimney above the Sistine Chapel a few moments ago. That means no pope has been elected today. The large, ornate wooden doors to the Sistine Chapel closed about 2.5 hours ago. Inside, 115 cardinals met to begin the secret process of electing a pope. Sitting at 12 conference tables beneath Michelangelo's magnificent ceiling, the cardinals' first decision was whether to start voting today or tomorrow. Evidently, they took a ballot today, and evidently, no one has been elected. As a sign of the times, a false floor covered by a beige carpet was built inside the chapel to hold high-tech jamming devices to prevent electronic eavesdropping. We'll hear more about the start of today's conclave in just a moment, but most of this hour will focus on the power of the pope, any pope. How much influence does the head of the Roman Catholic Church wield as the ultimate guardian of faith and morals? How much does his power flow from his character and personality? How much from the position itself? Later in the program, stories of race, politics, and anger radiate from a car accident in Los Angeles. Writer-director Paul Haggis and actor Brendan Fraser join us to talk about their new movie, Crash. But first, the power of the pope. How much influence does a pope have on you? If you're Catholic, do you live by his instructions on matters of faith and morals, or by your own conscience? Should the rules for Catholics be the same everywhere? Does the pope influence non-Catholics? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We go first to Rome to get the latest on today's events at the Vatican. David Willey, the BBC's Rome correspondent, joins us. David, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much.
So at 8 o'clock this evening, Rome time, where we learned that the first ballot was inconclusive.
I have just returned to my office from the Vatican, and as I was in my taxi on the way back, I heard about the black smoke. So there's been one ballot, an unsuccessful one. This is no surprise, because it was very unlikely that in their first ballot the cardinals would be able to make a firm choice. In order to get a winning majority, the future pope has to get two-thirds plus one of the cardinals, and that was clearly unthinkable on the first ballot.
One of those touted as a potential pope was Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, the dean of the College of Cardinals. People remember he led the pope's funeral mass. He spoke earlier today at a mass inside St. Peter's Basilica. Tell us about that.
Well, he did. He warned the cardinals against what he called the dangers of religious sects and relativism. That's the way he describes Catholics who would like to follow their own desires rather than the dictates of Holy Mother Church. And it was a rather vigorous recall to orthodoxy that he made. Not surprising, given that for the past 20 years and more, he's run the department of the Vatican known as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. That used to be known as the Holy Office, and even earlier, it used to be known as the Inquisition. In other words, his job has been to root out heresy and error from Catholic doctrine. And he's disciplined several extremely well-known Catholic theologians, including several Americans.
And indeed, and as we mentioned, he is considered one of the front runners. After that, then there was resort to ritual, if you will, tradition, ceremony, as the cardinals retired to the Sistine Chapel.
It was a very impressive ceremony. They lay on a very good show at the Vatican, and this was no disappointment. The cardinals, all dressed in their red robes and wearing their red hats, walked in procession from a chapel in the Apostolic Palace. That's the building where the popes past and present and future live. And they walked into the Sistine Chapel, this magnificent chapel decorated by one of the great artists of the Renaissance, Michelangelo. And there they sat at a series of long trestle tables, and they lined up and swore an oath of secrecy and an oath of loyalty to the church. have to do this in order to follow the rather elaborate rules of this election, which is really unlike any other political election in the world. The cardinals are now locked inside an area inside Vatican City, and they won't really emerge until they have elected a new pope, however long that takes. It could be a day, 2 days, 3 days. It could be a week. It could even extend more than a week.
And in previous elections, the most recent, of course, more than a quarter century ago, but the conditions in which they lived were rather Spartan, in part to, I think, encourage quick decisions. But those conditions have changed along with the rules.
Well, that's right. This time, the Pope, the late Pope, built a luxury hotel in the Vatican territory, just a stone's throw from St. Peter's Basilica. So basically, the cardinals, instead of living in rather Spartan, temporary accommodation, now have proper hotel rooms. They have a proper bathroom. Everyone has, some of the lucky cardinals have actually suites in the hotel. They have regular meals, and the conditions are really better than they ever have been before in history. So some people have been suggesting that this, of course, could mean that the cardinals are quite prepared to take their time. There's no pressure. They're cut off from the outside world. They've had to hand in their cell phones. They've been checked for bugs by electronic technicians from the Vatican. And basically, they're now incommunicado from the outside world until the new pope emerges.
A few of them, though, did give some interviews before all of this secrecy was sworn in. Any hints about what they're concerned about as this conclave begins?
Oh, yes. We know what the concerns are. It all depends, though, of course, from what part of the world the cardinals come. I think the cardinals of the developing countries feel that the time may have come for one of them, for an African or a Latin American, to be elected pope, because Africa is the fastest-growing area of Catholic missionary activity, and Latin America, in fact, the Americas as a whole, are where half the world's Catholic population lives. So there clearly will be some pressure on many cardinals to think, well, it may be time, after having the first non-Italian pope in 450 years, to elect a second non-Italian pope from a different part of the planet.
And I wonder, you've lived there in Rome for many years now, David Willey, what's going to be the reaction of the people on St. Peter's Square and throughout Italy to the election of this pope?
Well, the Romans are very, very interested in papal elections because if you know your history, you know that the popes used to be the rulers, the temporal rulers of the of not only the city of Rome, but of all the area around it, of this part of central Italy. And there's a strong bond between the pope and the people of Rome. He is, after all, the bishop of Rome. And so they turn out in their favor. They were there tonight in St. Peter's Square, big crowd, not really in the expectation that there would be a decision tonight, but Romans like going there when they feel there's something important going on. It was interesting that Pope John Paul, the Pope from Poland, during his more than quarter of a century here, established quite a strong bond with the people of Rome. He'd learned Italian before he became Pope. He spoke good Italian. And what was rather touching was that as Bishop of Rome, in addition to all these international visits he carried out, once a month about, he used to visit one of the parishes of Rome. He used to do a normal parish visit, just like any other bishop, and the people loved that. There was a really strong relationship between the Pope and the people of Rome, which is, of course, the historical reason why there was a Pope at all, because the first Pope was the Bishop of Rome.
David Willey, thank you very much. We appreciate your time this evening. David Willey is a correspondent for the BBC, and he joined us from Rome. Again, if you've just joined us about 10 minutes ago or so, black smoke began to emerge from the top of the Sistine Chapel. That indicates an inconclusive ballot was held. The cardinals will now retire for the evening, and balloting will continue tomorrow. And we turn now to our discussion of the power of the Pope. How much influence does the head of the Catholic Church wield as the guardian of faith and morals? How much does his power flow from his character and personality, and how much from the position himself? Again, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now are two noted theologians. John Peter Pham is a former Vatican diplomat, author of Heirs of the Fishermen, Behind the Scenes of Papal Death and Succession. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you on the program again.
Pleasure to be with you.
And also with us is Father Charles Curran, Professor of Human Values at Southern Methodist University. He's written several books on the Catholic Church, the most recent, The Moral Theology of Pope John Paul II, and he joins us from radio station KVIL in Dallas, Texas. And it's good of you to be with us today.
Nice to be with you.
John Peter Pham, the Pope holds several kinds of power. He heads up a bureaucracy that keeps the Vatican running on a day-to-day basis, the Curia. As the leader of the world's 1 billion Catholics, he's also a religious leader, a man of faith. Talk about the differences between those two kinds of power, if you would.
Well, it's good that we make that distinction. There's certainly the religious power, which ultimately is founded upon individual conscience and upon the influence that one can make upon another, any other human being upon another, through conviction and convincing them of the truth that one seeks to propose. And that's, if you will, a soft power that the Pope has. On the other hand, the Pope also has what I would term, borrowing parlance from political science, a hard power in the control that he exercises over the Roman Curia, the appointment of bishops throughout the Catholic Church, and also in a level unseen since really the High Middle Ages, John Paul's playing of global actor, his involvement in various international, multilateral international forums and conferences, and unprecedented diplomatic activity. The Vatican maintains diplomatic relations with 175 countries, which is actually one more than the U.S. government does. And so there's a power there. But the two are not unrelated, because the strength of the Pope's ability to speak in international conferences is directly related to, ultimately, to the strength of his ability to convince his own fellow believers and other Christians and people of goodwill to follow his lead.
Father Curran, we'll get back to you in just a moment. I've timed this poorly. We have to cut away for a station break just now, but we'll be back right after the break to talk more about the Pope's hard and soft power. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how much of a Pope's influence stems from his position or his personality. Of course, you're invited to join our conversation. If you're Catholic, how much weight do you give to what the Pope says or does? What influences you, the religion's doctrine or its leader? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guests are former Vatican diplomat John Peter Pham and Father Charles Curran, the author of The Moral Theology of Pope John Paul II. And Father Curran, just before the break, we were talking about hard and soft power of the papacy. You got to see some of that hard power firsthand.
Yes, at one time I did.
I should point out, you had a teaching position at Catholic University here in Washington and were forced to leave it in 1986.
Yes, the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, with the approval of the Pope, said that I was no longer suitable nor eligible to be a professor of Catholic theology. The reason for that was because of my dissenting positions on issues such as divorce, contraception, sterilization, a little bit on abortion, homosexuality, divorce, etc.
I wonder, having gone through that experience, if you agree with John Peter Pham's borrowing of that political science terms of hard power and soft power, the Pope.
Well, I'm a theologian, not a political scientist, but I think what we have to distinguish, though, with regard to church understanding of things, is the fact that there are certain teachings that are core and central to Catholic faith, and there are others that are more remote, removed, and peripheral. And I have always argued that to be a good Roman Catholic, one obviously has to agree with the core teachings, the Trinity, the Jesus, salvation, redemption, human sinfulness, the sacraments, the Bishop of Rome, bishops in the church. But other areas are more remote and peripheral. And these, for example, in the area of moral teachings, over the course of history, Catholic moral teachings have changed dramatically. One of the sorriest periods of our history, I think, was the fact that it took the Roman Catholic Church and the popes 19 centuries to condemn slavery. So we have illustrations of many changes that have occurred in Catholic moral teaching. And usually history reminds us those changes always started from the bottom up, from the grassroots.
Mm-hmm. And John Peter Pham, one question that has arisen, we've all seen opinion polls published in this country over the past weekend that showed many American Catholics disagree with the teaching of the Church on some of those issues that Father Kern was just talking about. Should the rules be different for Catholics in different places?
Well, I think before we address that, we have to address the concern of, I think, any observer, much less one who loves the Church, is that there's no area where Catholic official teaching as proclaimed by the Vatican and the lived experiences, convictions of so many believers is so great as in these very basic matters of faith and life and personal morality. And one can't sustain a gap that large over a prolonged period, whether that gap be an exclusively North American phenomenon, which I don't believe it is, or it's a gap that's experienced by people in the global South and Europe and in other places as well. One of the titles of the Pope is that of Pontiff. It comes from the Roman Pontifex, bridge builder. And ultimately, I think the figure that is elected to this office has to be that of a bridge builder to prevent these types of gaps from growing to the point where they threaten those core beliefs that Father Curran just spoke about.
Mm-hmm. Those gaps do, though, have seemed to have widened over the past several years, Father Curran.
Yes, I think so. But on the one hand, I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think one realizes then the fact that there are these different levels of church teaching and that one can dissent. Now, I think Dr. Pham is right to point out that the gap can become too great. And that's obviously where problems are. I mean, quite frankly, the major problems today that people experience are where it's a question of official church structures. I mean, as we know, the vast, vast majority of Roman Catholics disagree and act against the papal teaching on no contraception for spouses. Many Catholics disagree on other things, and in a sense, they're free to do so. But the problems arise where you have church structures. For example, the whole question of the ordination of women. You can't solve that problem in conscience. You run into that whole issue then. And those are the issues that, in a certain sense, have become more acerbic because of time.
We want to get listeners involved in this conversation. Again, the number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. Let's begin with Diane. Diane's calling us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi.
Hi.
Your interviewer, when she'd interviewed me, she'd asked if I was Catholic, and I just wanted to let you know that I'm real Catholic. I've got the our genealogical records back to 1726, and there's been a priest and or nun in our family since that time, and we've even got a blessed a person who's up for sainthood, Adele Quinn, who helped bring the Legion of Mary to Africa, and so I'm real Catholic. Although I wasn't raised Catholic, I turned Catholic as a choice. My mom is, her background is Native American, so I was more familiar with that until I became Catholic. And up until the Pope is real removed, I live more by my conscience, and that's probably my Native American heritage, my training there. I don't agree with the church doctrine regarding the contraceptive, birth control, that type. I don't agree with their stance on abortion, and I definitely don't agree with their stance on ordination of women. I can't see there's nothing from the studies that I've done over the years. There's nothing that I can see that doesn't allow women to be ordained as priests, because the way I've read the Bible, and I've read several different versions, and I've also read the Coptic versions, the Nag Hammadi texts, that type. I've done a lot of study, and I can't see where they're coming up with this position.
Well, some you described yourself as a real Catholic, Diane. Others
real in heritage.
Yeah, others might describe you as a Catholic a la carte. You pick the parts you like and throw away the parts you don't.
Yeah, you probably could describe me as that and be real accurate with that too. But you know, there's free will, and my free will is to question, and I think that it's my duty to question, just like. You know, being American, my duty is to question our government. As a Catholic, my duty is to question the pontiff and the direction in which the church is being led.
Is the duty of a Catholic to question the pontiff, John Peter Pham?
Well, I think the duty of any Christian, really, or any person who's pursuing truth, the Second Vatican Council invited, in fact, stated it was an inherent nature of humanity to seek the truth. One cannot seek truth in a vacuum. One has to seek truth by questioning things. The scholastic philosophers and theologians in the Middle Ages once said that the weakest argument was to argue from authority. And so there certainly should be a critical examination of issues before one can embrace. If one embraces without that examination, one wonders what it is one embraces.
I can't be led around by the nose.
Diane, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with John, and John's calling us from San Jose, California.
Hey, Neil.
Hey.
I just wanted to say that I think the Pope sets the stage a lot of time. Like the President of the United States, he can set the agenda just by having his platform to voice an opinion on different political positions. In contrast to your last caller, I was raised Catholic, but I would not describe myself as Catholic now, although I still have my confirmation name, so I think I can put my 2 cents in. And as a gay man, I think it's hard to watch somebody with such perceived moral authority as the Pope to come across and say that gay marriage, you know, can be compared to child abuse in some of his recent papers. So I just wanted to say that. I think the Pope does wield a lot of power, and I don't know if that's hard or soft, but it's definitely detrimental to a lot of people.
Okay, John, thanks very much for the phone call. Father Curran, this past Pope addressed these issues as taking a very long view, I mean, as eternal verities. And of course, you argue that obviously the Church has changed its position on a lot of moral issues over the years, but he didn't see it that way. And given the fact that he appointed the man likely to be his successor, is this likely to change, do you think?
Well, I think it will take some time to change, but I also think change comes from underneath. I mean, it's fascinating. I think Diane's talk there was the same as we've heard from so many polls, that people already are disagreeing. I mean, in a certain sense, you could argue that the Church's teaching has already changed on some of these matters.
You're referring to polls as opinion polls, not people from Poland, but go ahead.
That's correct, yes. So I think it is. But I don't like the term a la carte Catholic, because I think that fails to recognize the distinction between the core aspects. If I disagree with the core aspects, I just don't think I can be a Catholic. I mean, I have to accept some of the basic notions of faith. But I think there's a great room for disagreement on these peripheral issues.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Cynthia. Cynthia is with us from San Antonio.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. My position is that the Pope receives his inspiration through God or for divine inspiration, and hopefully his decisions are made that way. And I believe that Pope John Paul was a very holy man and that he did listen to God and to the Holy Spirit. And a lot of times the decisions that he made were decisions that were not popular with a lot of people, contraceptives and going to war in Iraq. He was not in favor of either one of those. So he took political stances and on moral issues also that were not very popular, but I believe that they were in alignment with what this world needs to come back to. And maybe if we really did follow those divine inspirations, the world would be a lot better off than what it is right now. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, just Cynthia, quickly, I wonder, you were talking about Pope John Paul II. Do you accept these teachings from him because of his particular strength and character and his values, or would you take that from any pope?
there is quite a bit of conflict in the Catholic Church right now, and I'm wondering who is going to be elected. There's a lot of division within the American Catholic Church between those who follow Orthodox Catholic teachings and those who do not. It depends on, you know, well, I hope that the pope that the cardinals elect will be a pope inspired by God, but I'm not always sure that in this election that the person who is chosen will be divinely inspired or mainly humanly inspired. There is a lot of cardinals that do not follow the traditional Catholic teachings, and so I'm waiting to see what's going to happen. My own personal beliefs are that I will follow a pope that follows the traditional Catholic teachings. I was an atheist, and I changed late in life to become Catholic, and I chose that religion over all the other religions because of their basis of morality and because I believe that Jesus named Peter to be the first pope, and all the popes and all the Catholic religion is based on obedience, obedience to God, obedience to Jesus, and obedience to Pope. And if there are cardinals that do not follow or priests that do not follow the Pope and the traditional teachings of the Catholic Church that's in our faith that we have chosen to believe, we need to belong to another religion and not to the Catholic religion. That's just my own personal belief.
Cynthia, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much. Bye.
We're talking about the power of the Pope, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Father Curran, I wanted to ask you what Cynthia was just talking about. Again, according to opinion polls, a lot of Americans disagree with the teachings, but certainly she is not alone, and she has there are many people like her around the world.
Oh, I think there are. But I think, you know, among a number of Catholic people, people disagree with various parts. The people who might disagree with me on some of the sexual and personal issues and agree with the Pope often disagree with the Pope on his opposition to capital punishment, his opposition to the war in Iraq, his opposition to forms of capitalism.
And those principles, I wonder, we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask both of you, we're talking about divisions, and obviously as the conclave begins, and then the different issues that are dividing people, what about the nature of the Pope himself, whomever it may be, what about that unites people? John Peter Pham.
Well, certainly, as Catholics, we believe that the Bishop of Rome has a particular ministry within the church to serve as a center of visible unity. But as we've discussed in this discussion, there are different ways, modalities of expressing that unity and living that unity on a day-to-day, ordinary basis. So I think all Catholics will be excited by the election of whoever emerges from the conclave as another link in that visible chain that Catholics believe goes back historically to that fisherman, Simon Peter, who was made the rock by Jesus Christ. But that being said, we will have to continue with the same discussion on the modalities of how we visibly live that unity and what are the essentials and what are the other things that we ought to allow greater liberty of thought and expression for.
And Father Curran, the same question to you as these cardinals gather to consider who should be the next pope. What is it that this office, this person embodies that unites Catholics around the world?
Well, I think by definition, the papal office is to be a center of unity in the church. Now, I think one of the problems that we've had, though, is the fact that we have made the papal office too much like a monarchy. And quite frankly, under the papacy of John Paul II, the papal office became much more authoritarian and much more centralized than it had been in the past right after Vatican II. Vatican II called for collegiality. It called for the bishops together with the pope. It called for a greater role for the local churches, for national churches. And unfortunately, with the present, with the papacy of John Paul II, there was a tendency toward a much greater centralization. And quite frankly, you people in the media haven't helped us much because you have emphasized this whole notion of sort of the imperial papacy, and you've forgotten all about the fact that the church is not a monarchy.
Well, some of us have, maybe, and some of us hasn't. But I'm afraid we're going to have to leave the conversation there for today. Father Curran, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Curran, professor of human values at Southern Methodist University, author of The Moral Theology of Pope John Paul II, and he was kind enough to join us today from radio station KVIL in Dallas, Texas. And John Peter Pham, thank you as well.
Pleasure to be with you.
John Peter Pham, former Vatican diplomat, the author of Heirs of the Fisherman, Behind the Scenes of Papal Death and Succession, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, director Paul Haggis and actor Brendan Fraser join us to talk about their new movie, Crash. I'm Neil Cownan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.